Welcome to Parents' Perspective. What are you doing? Monica spotted 7-year-old Aaron on his way out the door holding a large metal shovel. Oh, I'm working in the backyard, he called out as the screen door slammed behind him. Monica went to the kitchen window and looked out. It was hard to see what he was doing, but since it didn't seem to involve electrical wires, she sighed to herself, it was probably okay. After 3/4 of an hour went by, Monica couldn't contain her curiosity any longer. She walked across the damp grass and stood by her son's side. He was leaning on the shovel and covered in mud up to his knees.
I'm working on a canal,
he smiled up at her brightly.
See?
He gestured. It'll run all the way across the back, and when it's done, I can put my boats in it.
That's a lot of work, his mom responded, trying to ignore her vision of mud everywhere in the house.
Yeah, he grinned, but I can do it.
From a parent's perspective, why is it so important to provide and support our children's unstructured time, and how can we do it best? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has a lot of experience with children and their creativity. Chris Mercoliano has been a teacher at the Albany Free School, a unique, freedom-based inner-city alternative school, since 1973. He became co-director in 1985. He's the author of Teaching the Restless, One School's Remarkable No-Ritalin Approach to Helping Children Learn and Succeed, How to Grow a School, and Making It Up as We Go Along, The Story of the Albany Free School. His most recent book is In Defense of Childhood, Protecting Kids' Inner Wildness. His essays, commentaries, and reviews have appeared in numerous newspapers, journals, magazines, and anthologies, and he's currently a columnist for Encounter, Education for Meaning and Social Justice. He has 2 daughters who are young adults. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Chris.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
In your book, Defending Childhood, the subtitle is Protecting Kids' Inner Wildness. What do you mean by inner wildness, and why is it important?
Inner wildness is really my name for the soul. Since I write about children, I wanted a term that particularly described the amazing uniqueness of children, the exuberance, that quality that draws us to babies and causes us to stare at little kids while they're playing. So by inner wildness, I mean that essence, that inner spark. And maybe the most important thing of all is it conveys the idea that children are born with a very accurate inner guidance system. That's kind of been the key to my work as a teacher all these years. That's kind of the core principle of the philosophy of my school back in Albany, and was kind of the underlying idea in my parenting my own 2 daughters.
This almost sounds like the historic myth of the noble savage from centuries past. Today's kids have so many opportunities for stimulation and learning. Were previous generations better off than these kids are today?
I think the thing to understand about childhood throughout the ages is that as a group, children have borne more than any other group the abuse of history. So no, I wasn't intending to romanticize childhood in the past. Go back to the 19th century, and the infant mortality rate was 1 in 4. Childhood was no picnic. Childhood just changes with the times, and children have to change with the times. So no, I don't mean that. But what I'm deeply concerned about is that you can trace a pattern over the past several centuries whereby childhood is becoming more and more controlled. It's becoming a controlled experience. Like so much of modern life, it comes out of a box now. It's prepackaged. Children's experience is just increasingly managed. In fact, I see it getting so bad today that really, if you look carefully, you can see that just about every moment of a child's life, from the moment they're born, right on through childhood, through adolescence, into early adulthood, it is controlled in some way from the outside. And in terms of this idea that there's an inner spark that needs to be nurtured and fed and protected, that kind of management and control, which I call domestication in the book, is not a good thing.
For optimum development of a child, what would you say the essential ingredients are?
Number one ingredient, and this is not scientific, but it's my personal belief, is love. I don't know if you remember who Leo Buscaglia was, but he was a famous psychologist in the 70s, 80s. He was a teacher as well. He wrote book after book about love. So children need to be loved. Students in school need to be loved. I like to refer now to a very mainstream psychological theory. Very mainstream. It's from two research psychologists from the University of Rochester, Edward Deci and Richard Ryan, who've spent their entire careers, 30 years or more, working on this theory of human development, which they call self-determination theory. And I love it for its simplicity as much as anything else. They say that you can boil the whole thing down to three basic human needs that children are born with. One is the need to explore and master their environment. It's kind of like the need to be competent. That's like an instinctive need that children, and we see that with babies, that the moment they're born, they start to exercise that instinct and to explore that need and try to fulfill that need. The second is the need for autonomy. Children have an instinctive need to be able to do things themselves, to be independent. We see that with two-year-olds, sometimes even a little younger. Once they can say that, it's just three words, me do it. They want to do it themselves. It's not that they don't need or want help sometimes, but that inner urge, right, that instinct, that need to do it themselves is so powerful. And then the third one is the need for relationships, to be connected to others, to be connected to one's world. And we're not talking just superficial connections, but a need to be intimately connected to one's environment.
We had a funny story that ties in with that. It happened yesterday. I got a telephone call from one of my children who has a seven-month-old. And he said, well, I was trying to reach you earlier, but I didn't think I needed to call poison control. I said, all he can do is scoot backwards on the floor or roll around. How could he get into poison? So my son said, well, he got himself across the kitchen and put his head in the cat's dish. I said, well, what happened? He said, well, I don't know if he ate anything because the cats eat as soon as you feed them. So there wasn't a whole lot in there. But he was laughing and giggling and he thought it was just this wonderful thing. He was exploring an area that he hadn't been in before. So I told my son, I really thought that was probably okay, even if he ate cat food. But we had a good giggle over that. And that was the beginnings of all this independence.
Absolutely.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on enabling childhood.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with author Chris Mercogliano about enabling childhood.
One of my earliest childhood memories is getting into the dog food, which was stored under the kitchen sink. I couldn't have been more than two, and it was so good and crunchy. And, and my mother would yell at me, of course, whenever I'd managed to get into it.
What do you see as the threats to the kinds of self-discovery that children need to experience that you were just talking about?
There are a lot of them, unfortunately, today. There are just proliferation of threats. In the book, I say that the single greatest enemy of inner wildness is school and schooling. I'm careful to say and schooling because, unfortunately, especially today, school doesn't end with the end of the school day. School is growing. Its web is spreading in terms of children's lives. It influences far more than the school day. Unfortunately, as I'm feeling is happening to all of childhood, the educational process is becoming so scripted. In terms of my concern about this idea of inner wildness, children's need for original experience and adventure and so on.
I remember John Holt used to say that if we taught children to walk the way we teach them a lot of other subjects, we would have invalids.
Right, a nation of cripples, that's what he said. Wow. Or a nation of mutes. Right. We wouldn't be able to speak very well either. Mm-hmm. The quantity of education has increased so much. Kids just spend more time in school quantitatively than I did when I went to public school, but kids are in school a lot more than they were when I was a child. And then the school day extends sometimes to before school. They include academic stuff. There's such a heightened concern about children's academic performance and about standards today that if kids are in a before-school program, chances are they aren't allowed to just play. There's some kind of school experience attached to it. And then you see in preschools and daycares now that academic training is extending all the way down to the two-year-old group. You'll see there'll be part of the day now devoted toward some kind of academic training, getting them ready for when they're three, and which gets them ready for when they're four. And then, of course, looming ahead is kindergarten and first grade. And then after-school programs, the same story. It's based around kids doing their homework and da-da-da-da. Yeah. Maybe a little play sprinkled in, but not much. And that varies by region and by school. But I don't ever remember doing homework. I don't know if we had homework or not, but I don't remember doing it. I think if we had homework, it was so simple that I must have done it during the school day. Because in elementary school or junior high, I don't ever remember doing homework. And then there's, again, the qualitative issue. This whole teach-to-the-test modality where you reduce education to what another very mainstream psychologist calls the receptacle model, where you're just pouring information in is all you're doing. And then another friend of mine calls it the bulimia model, because then you gorge yourself with this data, and then you spit it back up on the test paper, and then you forget it in terms of a child's need for experience that helps them discover who they are and what they're passionate about, why they're here, why they're on this earth in the first place. Education is a monster.
What did you do if you weren't doing homework? What do you remember doing before and after school?
Before school, I delivered the Washington Post every damn morning. It was a lot of work. It was every morning, 5 till 7. I had a pretty big route, but I was rich. They paid well even then. And I was making like $100 a month in 1965.
That's a lot of money for
kids. That's a lot of money. And I always had what I wanted. I wanted to buy something, a baseball glove. We didn't have a lot of money. In terms of that need for autonomy, money is very important. I have a whole chapter in the book on work, by the way, because work has disappeared. The only work that children do anymore is homework. And that doesn't satisfy that inner need for competence and autonomy. Money is power, and I was rich and always could do and have what I wanted when I was a child. So after school, we just played. And I walked home from school so that the adventure began the minute I left the doors of Janney Elementary. I mean, different things would happen. Every day was different. And I'd go home and I just played until it was dark, played until after dark. We played flashlight tag. During my childhood, my time after school was entirely my own. So that's why I didn't mind school that much. It was in the book, I make the point that school actually was a minor interruption in my day. And that's kind of, I think, the way I treated it.
How can we assist our children in this journey if we'd also like them to take advantage of some of the opportunities around them, like music lessons or gymnastics, soccer, swim team, school newspaper, scouting, things they might like to do? There seems to be so little free time left if kids also have their homework and chores.
There's a couple of parts to it. One is, I think it's fine for children to do cool, exciting, extracurricular things. I think it's important that some of those experiences can be the ones that nourish children's inner wildness. I would just say, bottom line is, are the children choosing to do them? Is it coming from the children's own passion, their desire to pursue their gifts? Is the motivation coming from somewhere else? I think as long as the motivation is coming from the child, different children are different. Some children don't mind being really busy and going from one thing to another. Some of us have driven, sort of the type A personality, it has to do with inborn temperament, whereas some other children are more dreamy or whatever, and they want to sit around and think their own thoughts. Children are very different. Second thing is, things like homework, I encourage parents not to treat them as a given. The child is bringing home several hours of homework a night to the point where there isn't any time for them even to do chores, let's say, and I think children should do chores. I think it's an important part of a child's development. And back to that idea of work. It's the only way you get that feeling of competence and autonomy and belonging is if you're helping out. You're part of the family. I think children get very entitled if they're not even required to do the simplest chores at home. So I encourage parents to fight back. Don't just accept that as a given. Children shouldn't have several hours of homework a night. There's tons of research out there. A lawyer in New York wrote a book called The Case Against Homework recently, Sarah Bennett. And she wrote the book because her children were in some private school outside of New York City, and she was concerned about how much homework they had. So she and her husband and some other parents got together, and they fought back. They started going to parent meetings at the school. And she did a lot of research, which shows that in terms of increasing learning, in terms of being truly educational, especially below the high school level, there's no research that shows that homework is educational. It's just busy work. It's just reinforcing compliance in children. Mostly it just sets parents and children fighting with each other over homework. So don't just passively accept that whole situation, is what I say to parents, is try to change that, because those hours in the evening are precious and they shouldn't just be gobbled up doing this meaningless busy work.
It sounds too like if we want the kids to have some free time in the evening, we almost need to model that a little bit for them, because we're very often programmed and structured and rushing from one thing to the next.
Oh, absolutely. You've come to the core of the whole issue, I think, which is parents as models. It's just so critically important what we model for our children, because that's what our children get. Do as I say, you know, don't do as I... No, it doesn't work. They do as we do. From the moment they're born, they're studying us. That emotional umbilical cord, we're connected to our children very deeply. In every way, it's critical that we show them the way and make sure that we're living interesting, exciting lives, that we're living for ourselves and not just slaves to our careers or our jobs, and make sure we're not victims of circumstance. If we're living engaged lives and taking good care of ourselves, not working too hard, ta-da, our children will very naturally follow.
You're the director of what is referred to as an alternative school, but what can public schools do to free kids to explore their developing inner selves that you were talking about when the states mandate all kinds of standards and proficiency and so on?
There's two parts to the answer, or two levels to the answer. It's kind of a macro level and a micro level, I would say. On the macro level, schools don't have to passively put up with the No Child Left Behind regime. In fact, I think there are a dozen or more states that have joined together and filed a class action suit against the federal government because they don't want to have to comply with all these policies. So schools can fight back. They don't just have to accept that, oh, there's nothing we can do about this. And I think they should fight back. Here's where it gets tricky. My heart goes out to teachers today in the public schools because, you know, it's tough. They don't have much power. They do have to worry about their jobs. Their job status, I think, is probably more vulnerable than ever. So I certainly don't want to profess that every teacher who isn't happy with the regimen they're having to push kids through should march into the principal's office and say, I want to talk. I'm not going to say that. But I know teachers who do find ways to reshape conditions in their schools. They just have to be creative about it and diplomatic about it. But I know schools where teachers get together themselves and talk, and they come up with creative strategies for trying to carve out a little bit of space in the school day where they can let kids be themselves. So that's possible on that level. And then I think there are things individual teachers can do in their own classrooms. I just feel like the most important thing is more attitudinal. And that's kind of where I was coming from in the book. I more wanted teachers to have this big picture look at childhood and this sense that all of childhood is getting squeezed. We need to reverse that process in every area as much as we can. So if teachers just can appreciate their students as individuals and care about them as individuals. I spent a day with a PE teacher down in Southern Virginia, public school, elementary school PE teacher. And he's not quite as restricted as a regular classroom teacher. But at the same time, he's got a curriculum that he has to run these kids through. He can't just do whatever he wants. He has to test them. They have the whole president's physical fitness thing that started way back when the Kennedy administration. So he's got to put the kids through this thing. It's gotten quite extensive, actually. So he's got standards he has to hold these kids to, and he's got to test them. And he's feeling pretty cramped by the whole thing because he's a veteran teacher. I watched how he is with his students. And because he cares about them and understands them as children, he understands that when they come into his PE class, they are going to be a bit rambunctious at first. They're going to want to talk and be social because he sees now that the whole rest of the day, there's no time anymore for them to be social. And so that the whole tenor of his class was beautiful. And I could see the children receiving that. They could see that this guy really cared about them, really respected them, understood that they had these needs that actually weren't being met very well anymore. And he was able to humanize the whole thing to a staggering degree. Now, another thing teachers can do, this is just a very practical thing, is their classrooms are kind of like little mini societies, and they can close the door, and they can empower kids to help make the rules for the classroom. They can have some sort of circle or meeting structure where kids work out their differences with each other rather than the teacher just stepping in all the time and sorting things out. The children very much participated in governing our school and in working their problems out with each other. And we, of course, have a lot of time to devote to that process. But in public schools, there's still teachers say they find time a few times a week or at the end of every school day or whatever to have the kids sit in a circle and learn these skills. And they say it works really well. Changes the whole atmosphere when you give kids that message that they are responsible beings and that they can be trusted and that they are smart.
They're finding out through experiences like that that there are people listening and interested in what they have to share.
Yep, exactly.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on enabling childhood.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with author Chris Mercoliano about enabling childhood.
Can parents be helpful and support that kind of outlook and that kind of behavior? Would that be something that parents could do that would be a positive thing?
Well, it's absolutely critical that parents in some way be involved with the school. And I know that's hard. I don't want to be preachy here. There isn't much time. It's tough. There's a lot of pressure. But it's just critical. If parents can be in some way involved to make sure to go to those open houses, to make sure to have a personal relationship with the teacher, and to let the teacher know that you're on the teacher's side. I think that really helps teachers. I think when teachers know the families, they know they have the family's support, they know they can be a little bit more creative. That's what Inner Wildness wants. It needs that space for spontaneity and originality and self-direction.
Chris, in addition to your book, Defending Childhood, Protecting Kids' Inner Wildness, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue further some of the issues we've had the opportunity to discuss?
There's a beautiful book that came out recently with a great title called Last Child in the Woods. The author just makes such a great case and does it in a very moving way. The need for kids to continue to have contact with nature. And there are a lot of good suggestions in the book about how to do it. Getting back to schooling and education. If children are not thriving in school, then hopefully their parents are noticing that they're not thriving in school. And taking the next step, if parents are bringing their concerns to the school, to the teacher, to the principal, to the PTA, to the superintendent, and parents aren't feeling that they're being heard and nothing's changing, and they're still seeing signs that their children aren't thriving in school, and I emphasize the word thriving, not just getting by in school, not just passing, but thriving, because the school has become a significant portion of a child's daily experience. So then I encourage parents to start looking at alternatives. And the best source of information for that is the website of the Alternative Education Resource Organization, the acronym being AERO, A-E-R-O, because it just is a huge source of information about what's going on around the world, really, in terms of educational options. No one philosophy of education. It's just sort of an umbrella organization and a networking organization for everything out there that's allowing children to color outside the lines. And their website address is edrev.org. That's short for Education Revolution. They have a quarterly print magazine that they publish. It's quite excellent.
Well, this has been an eye-opening discussion for us, and we're sure for our listeners and everybody who is interested in the welfare of children and enabling childhood. So, Chris Mercoliano, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a great opportunity.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Chris Mercoliano's book, In Defense of Childhood, Protecting Kids' Inner Wildness. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573. 791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 353 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. Our special thanks for generous support for this program from the Evelyn Sachs Trust. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.